Hey, it's Mark. I wanted to let you know that Judy Woodruff is going to be joining us for the next Crosscut Festival. She's the anchor and managing editor of PBS NewsHour. She's covered politics and all kinds of other news for more than four decades at NBC, CNN, and PBS. And she's going to be moderating the festival's opening night keynote conversation. Who will she be interviewing? We're not quite ready to announce that yet, but if you'd like to go, buy your tickets now at crosscut.com/festival. The festival is happening May 1st and 2nd, 2020, and early bird ticket sales end on December 31st. Okay, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. Big tech has a diversity problem. People of color and women still represent a very small percentage of all employees at major tech companies. In 2017, for instance, African Americans made up just 3% of the workforce at Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Twitter. And women represent just a quarter of all workers in STEM fields. How do we change that? It takes more than just asking companies to do better. It also means creating more access to education and training. Crosscut gathered a panel of industry experts and diversity advocates to talk about what that access could look like. Naria Santalucia is the executive director of the Washington State Opportunity Scholarship, a public-private partnership that supports low-income college students working toward careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. She serves on several boards and committees, including with Columbia Legal Services, Goodwill, and the Washington State Governors STEM Alliance. Mary Snapp is the Corporate Vice President of Microsoft Philanthropies. She leads the team responsible for Microsoft's partnerships with nonprofits and communities. She began working at Microsoft in 1988 as the company's first female attorney and was the executive sponsor of its diversity and inclusion initiative for over a decade. Juan Otero is Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion for Comcast NBC Universal. He previously served as the Economic Development Committee Director for the National Governors Association in Washington, D.C., and as Deputy Director at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Bo-Young Lee is the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Uber. Before that, she was the Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Marsh & McLennan. She's also launched an effort to help dozens of other companies meet their diversity goals, including Marriott, John Deere, and Allstate. Crosscut staff reporter Manola Sakaira moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and WeWork. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Great. Hi, guys. Thanks all for coming to Planting Seeds for STEM. I'm Manola Sakaira. I just want to start with everyone getting to know each other. So if you guys want to just go around and introduce yourselves, what you do, and then why you're interested in this field, that'd be great.
Am I on? Oh, we are. My name is Mary Snapp. I lead our global philanthropies work for Microsoft. I have actually been at the company for quite a long time. I was the first female lawyer hired by the company 30 years ago when we were a legal department of about 12 people. So I have had lots of experience working as a lawyer. I supported all of our product and development efforts. So I worked with engineers day in and day out for the first 25 years or so before moving to the current role. And we'll love to talk about what it's like in terms of working in big tech, but in particular, the importance of STEM education for everyone. I mean everyone. Thanks.
Hi there, I am Bo-Young Lee, and I'm the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Uber. I've been there for about a year, and I've been in the D&I, organizational D&I space for almost 20 years, so I started in the field when almost nobody really wanted to talk about diversity in organizations, and now I'm in the other side where everybody wants to talk about it, so I've got to see that evolution, and you know, I myself am a byproduct of a STEM education, so I went to a science and math high school and almost became became, went into that field and then decided to pivot to diversity and inclusion. So yeah, I'm really passionate about this topic.
Hi, I'm Naria Santalucia. I'm the executive director of the Washington State Opportunity Scholarship. We are a first of its kind public-private partnership created here in Washington State really to answer the pipeline issue. So how do we make sure that every single Washington student has a chance to become educated and thrive in our current job and economy, which is really in STEM and in healthcare? And we were founded in 2011 with support from Microsoft and the state of Washington. We are a one-to-one match, so any private gift is matched by the state. We've raised $200 million for scholarships and supports, which I'm really excited about. And we actually have a scholar here in the room who is a graduate, Sydney. And you could ask her, because she is like, she is now working in the industry and kind of doing exactly what we intended to do. So super excited about that. And, you know, really, it's like, how do we make sure Washington kids have a chance for all these terrific jobs? And how do we make sure that they're supported and they stay in those roles? Really excited to be here. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm sorry, I'm still on East Coast. I'm not sure where. Juan Otero, I'm the VP for Diversity and Inclusion for Comcast, NBC, Universal. How I was always passionate about D&I, but my background, really, I was from the other Washington, D.C., where I worked on the Hill. My hair was a different color at that point when I started. But since that time, I always worked at the intersection of public policy and diversity and inclusion. It's like, and now as we see these conversations maturing, evolving across the country, when this opportunity to take over this office was presented to me, it was no question something that I cared about, was passionate about, and always happy to talk about.
Great, yeah. And Bo, you touched on this just as we were talking just now, but yeah, I was curious. I know that each of you have worked in this and in diversity and inclusion in different kinds of ways for years. And obviously the conversation around that has evolved in the past decade, even just a couple of years. So yeah, if you guys could just speak a little bit about how you've seen conversations around diversity and inclusion in workplaces and maybe even specifically in STEM evolve.
I can give it a start. I think people talked, you know, 20 years ago we started to talk about it, but it was actually, as Bo said, it was quite awkward. It was, some of the conversations even in the room were very difficult even to address. And I think we've come to the point now where these conversations are dedicated and intentional and focused. They are related to action and they are related to measurement. And I think that is a big difference between where we started. At the same time, the conversation has also gone well beyond just a question of measuring diversity, which I kind of equate to representation, and much more towards inclusion. And when we talk about inclusion, I don't know who first said it, but I remember a woman who told me diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. And that inclusion piece is much more a part of the conversation, and that goes to culture. So now we, I think, much more are talking about these conversations in terms of culture, and we are measuring and we are holding our leaders accountable for training and for their own work. So I think we've evolved quite a lot. We have tons more to do. And no one is content. Mm-hmm. Tons more to do. So I'll let others chime in. You probably...
So, you know, one of the interesting things that I've seen is, like, the organizational diversity and inclusion conversation is a byproduct of society. Like, you can't bifurcate, like, what's happening in the social sphere with what's happening within organizations. That's why it matters so much. And the thing about our society, and this is very U.S. specific, but if you think about the history of, like, you know, integration and so forth in our country, we went through this hyper-polarized period of time in the 50s, 60s, 70s, where, like, you know, there were, you know, marches and violence and all this stuff happening, both on the civil rights, race, ethnicity component, but also on the gender component. And then starting in the 1980s, I think people got a little exhausted, and we ended up reaching a very, like, unstable peace, a very minimized peace where we all decided, colorblindness. Colorblindness is the right way to go about it, right? We're not going to talk about like gender or race, ethnicity. It's not that you're a good female leader, you're just a good leader. Like, we decided minimization with the way, because we were frankly exhausted as a society. And then, and that was really the case for almost two decades, like this kind of unstable piece. And that's the that's the period of time, by the way, that millennials actually like were born and grew up. They grew up during this very unstable piece where they were actually not taught the language of how to have really challenging but necessary dialogues around difference. And then because of it was a very unstable piece, what actually started happening is we started repolarizing. And we're now living in a state right now in our society where we are more polarized than we were back in the 1980s and 1990s. You know, I don't have to prove the business case for D&I. It's like, open the newspaper. I mean, and it's happening on a global basis. Everywhere you look around the world, we're back in an era of strongmen, and that, you know, we're back in an era of like hyperpolarization from a political perspective. And so it's within that context, I think that's the reason why we're back to seeing D&I being such a hot topic within organizations. It's so important. And the thing about some of the evolution in technology is that we've given amplification to voices that historically in the past haven't had an opportunity to do so, and that and the awareness that these divergent voices exist is again feeding some, that awareness is feeding people's sense of polarization and threat. So one of the things that I think right now that we're, and the challenge with all of this combined, is that you have a generation of individuals who were fundamentally taught that they shouldn't talk about race, ethnicity, gender, and our differences, and now they're being forced to, and they're like, I don't have the language because my parents told me that when I saw a black person, like, oh, look, mommy, there's a black person. Don't say that. Well, it's a black person. But they were never taught that language. And so like a lot of millennials, and certainly within Uber, and I think in tech in general, one of the biggest things that I'm actually spending a lot of time teaching our younger workforce is the language of having constructive conversations around difference, and simply saying, she's a female leader. Female leader is not a pejorative, by the way. We make it sound, when you say, don't call her a female leader, you're fundamentally saying the word female is a pejorative in some way. That's a black leader. Why is black a pejorative? Why do I have to call them just a leader, right? We're giving them the language, and I think that's something that we're really starting to see now is the evolution, building on what you've said, is it's about diversity, it's about inclusion, and it's about giving people the language to have those conversations.
And I would say one thing really quickly is I think we are more and more looking to our corporations to lead this dialogue and less to government. And less to media, and you know, and corporations, I think, really are leading the dialogue.
That's a crazy thing. Like, suddenly, the corporations, and Juan, you know this, right? And I'm sure you experienced it. Like, corporations, like 20 years ago, corporations were like way far behind, and we were just catching up. And now it's suddenly like, I'm like, dude, corporations are like ahead. And I'm like, what kind of world is
that? I would just chime in here to be like, okay, so I think that there was a lot of like headling, you know, what we're talking about, the diversity versus inclusion. I really think that from WR perspective, opportunity scholarship, and where I really hope that companies eventually get to, is about equity. You know, it's really about equity, because you can be invited. I think that's awesome. I think the next phase is where people of color, where women, where we have not just like equity, like equitable practices, but where we have a voice at the table that's making the decisions, that is like transforming kind of where we go. So I've always said, like, can we think of a way, because I'm from the social services sector, right? So from social services, we do a lot in early learning. Then we pass them off to K-12. That pass off is a little iffy. Then we pass them off to college. That's really very iffy. Then really where the big iffy issue is where from college to industry, that pass off, like, people forget we need to keep supporting people. You can't just stop at K-12. You can't stop at college. You have to keep supporting them in the company. So how do we...
The continuous learning.
Exactly. Continuous learning, making sure that there are venues, because we were chatting, there are so many points where people of color, where women can stop out. And how do we make sure that, you know, we are really mindful of those? Because it doesn't matter how many starts people make at companies, if they don't stay, if they don't get that equity, if they don't get the decision-making power, the cycle is going to continue. We're going to get tired again. The next, you know, language where we're like, we don't really want to face this anymore, that's going to happen again. So, like, I'm super excited to see the young people in this room. I'm counting on you guys to be those at the table to make the decisions and kind of change, like, the structures.
I think this all ties together with the whole theme that I talk about in terms of intentionality, in terms of what exactly we can talk about D&I, we can have we can put out statistics once a year and then sort of pivot. But not having this constant conversation, the constant revisiting through metrics, through governance, to track your employees, to make aspirational goals, to say that the population is 50% women, we have 30% people of color, why doesn't our company look like that? At Comcast NBC Universal, it was, as one can imagine, sort of like, okay, are we going to say that publicly? Is my CEO going to say we're going to have that goal? And he did. I could spend all of this time, but I can tell you right now, just one stat that I'm always proud of is the VP level has increased by 70%. For the number of women at the director level and by 75% at the VP level. I mean, this is about a constant effort that does have some painful conversations. There are some issues where you have to, and then at the same time, I'll just add on to the lexicon piece, which I think is really important, is whereas I think there's that hesitancy, but there's also this evolving lexicon that, you know, you have to work with your senior leaders to make sure they're understanding when I think Latinx as opposed to thought I was Latino. But, you know, it's evolving. The LGBTQ+, that was not part of the social consciousness 5 years ago. I don't think we talked about it that way, not in sort of, you know, public forums. It just was not discussed. So this conversation in terms of how we continue, because it's not just, I think, working with folks coming through the pipeline, but it is also informing and educating your mainline supervisors, your board of directors. So that's why we've got a ton of training and effort that's constantly going at folks and through Comcast University, because the subject is evolving, and yes, it can be difficult.
Yeah. I really liked Bo's sense of where we were 20 years ago, because when I was sort of growing up in the beginning, we take these civics classes, which really probably don't many people teach them anymore, but the words that I remember is that America is a melting pot. And we all had to melt, apparently, to be some thing, glob thing. And, you know, very recently we are starting to talk about celebrating individual differences. And in particular, in the last little bit, I've read a book that many of you probably have read called Covering by Kenji Yoshino, who talks about being able to, as a culture and a company, celebrate people's differences, whether it is color, whether it is disability, whether it is a mental illness, whether it's veteran status, and, you know, identifying all the ways in which people feel that they have to cover in their work lives in order to, I suppose, melt, you know, which I'm so glad we're not doing anymore.
Yeah. And that melting that happens is, let's be frank, it's not to a neutrality, right? It's to a normative set of behaviors that were defined by the people in power, which happens to be largely cis, hetero, white men of upper middle to upper class behaviors, right? So if you are anything other than that, even a white, cis, straight, hetero male who came from like a lower income, you are covering the fact that you grew up poor. Like if I were to survey any of you who grew up in a lower socioeconomic class, whether you're male or white or whatever, you probably feel immense pressure to hide the fact that you grew up poor, right? You know, or if you're an immigrant or whatever. And so that covering is to a normative set of behaviors that less than 10% of us actually do, whether we're male or white or whatever. And that's the struggle. And when you spend some part, the amount of brain power that is spent on having to behave in a certain way means that you are suboptimized to actually perform at your highest and best self, right? If you had to, like, you know, if you had to be something else than what you are, even if you're not consciously thinking be something else, like some part of your brain is doing that. And that means that you're not adding that to create the solutions that lead to innovation, that lead to creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then just alongside that, I mean, narrowing down and focusing on STEM fields, when you guys have worked, or I guess when STEM workplaces are trying to be more inclusive and trying to incorporate more diversity in their workforce, what are the common pitfalls that you see, or maybe issues that you see them falling into?
You want me to?
Sure.
Being too polite to each other.
I know, we're being polite. But I'm kind of reacting to the word pitfall. And I'm kind of reacting a little bit negatively to that word, because we are going to make mistakes. And mistakes are going to be different depending upon the organization and the culture and where you are in terms of maturity on this topic. And so I want to avoid that word, because we need to move forward and recognize that we will make mistakes. Having said that, I do think that this is an ecosystem. So we've been talking about corporate culture, but I also think that we as corporations have a responsibility to ensure that as young people are coming of age, that they think about a career in STEM. So right now, there are 500,000 computing jobs open in the United States. About 70% of the computing jobs aren't even in the tech sector. They're in other companies, because almost every company has some computer science and a need for computer science. So we've got a tremendous demand. The issue in particular with girls is, one of the issues with girls, is that they don't necessarily see role models. And for young girls, role models are really important. So we have to really identify young women to young girls, I'm talking to you, to think about careers in engineering and math. There was a recent study, I just read it literally 2 days ago, that in eighth grade, girls right now are performing better than boys in engineering and math. But when we get to the high school, they are not taking the engineering and the math and the science courses. So they are really great at it, but something happens in those middle years. And I think role models are important. And we are increasingly also learning that having opportunities for girls, in particular, in groups with other girls, as opposed to boys and girls together in those middle years, is really important to keep girls excited and moving forward. So I think you have to use these kind of marketing terms, you have to sort of create the demand, you know, create the interest. And then part two is you need to provide the opportunity. And whether that's in a classroom, whether that's in an after-school program like a Boys and Girls Club or Black Girls Code, which, yay, just opened in Seattle last week, yay. You know, you have to create this opportunity and encouragement and mentorship.
I love what you said on so many different levels, and it reminded me of something that Carolyn Wanga, who's the Chief Diversity Officer at Target, said. She puts it really well. She says, fundamentally understand that diversity and inclusion is a series of failures until you stop failing. She goes, just accept that fact. She goes, you're going to do a million things and none of them are going to work, and then finally you do something and it works. You gotta keep trying, and anybody who's trying to lead this, either as when you in a role that actually gives you the ability to do it at a full time job, or if you're trying to influence something, the best thing you can fundamentally do is tell people we're gonna fail at this, and we're gonna fail at it a few times, and that's okay, and that's expected, because that means that we're trying. Because if this was easy, do you think our newspapers would look the way they do? The headlines on the newspapers, right? They wouldn't. If this was an easy thing to do, we would all be living in like a great harmonious world, but we don't. We're actually living in an increasingly polarized world. So lean into it. And there's also a really fundamentally awesome concept that I've been sharing this with everybody. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Kruger-Dunning effect. Really, really quickly, the Kruger-Dunning effect basically says it's an intellectual concept, and basically people of higher intellectual capability actually are more capable of figuring out exactly how intelligent they are, right? conversely, the people of maybe lower intellectual capability have a tendency to overestimate what their intellectual capability is. There's a very similar dynamic on the diversity and inclusion side, and they actually have done studies on this. People who presume themselves to be more egalitarian and meritocratic actually behave in ways that are actually less egalitarian and meritocratic. People who are more likely to assume and have awareness of what of their biases and their racism and their sexism and their homophobia actually behave in ways that are actually more meritocratic and egalitarian. So if you walk around, and this is a really good thought exercise for all of you, if you walk around assuming, as a human being, I am prone to biases. As a human being, even as a woman, I probably have some embedded sexism because our society is built on patriarchal ideas of sex, right? And gender. As a woman, I probably am prone to sexism. As a white person, I am prone to racist views around people with dark skin, black, Latinx. If you walk around actually thinking that, you are going to self-correct more to be more meritocratic, more egalitarian, and more fundamentally inclusive than if you walk around going, I'm a good person who doesn't see color and I'm not biased.
That's why the importance of the unconscious bias training that we've been talking about now for a number of years is just so important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I want to pick up a little bit on what Mary was saying, as far as, you know, the word of the pitfall and also just how do we, you know, it's really, I heard this great quote, I've been quoting it all over the place, but it's that our network is our net worth. I love that because it's so true. A lot of young people, women who may not have people around them in STEM who, you know, look like them, who they could ask for advice or mentorship from, people of color, they're not going to have that network available. So I think that in that case, tech companies and folks that are hiring, they need to create that network for their employees when they start and really be intentional about that. Build circles. I love the idea of circles and having communities that are like-minded, because when you look above you and there's nobody that looks like you, and we all know this, you're gonna stop out, you're gonna leave, mm-hmm. you're gonna go into another sector. And it is so exhausting, but I'm so glad you brought that up. It is really exhausting to move in this world as a person of color, as you know, somebody who's alone in a field, and you waste so much brain space, like second-guessing yourself. And even just having that ability to have conversation in a kind of maybe even an affinity group, I think will do wonders, would really do wonders and is really working.
Can I just add on? I think the challenges in STEM are, and this might be an oversimplification, no different from the other challenges that I think all the organizations are going. We have certainly some demographic issues that we need to certainly address with women, young girls, etc. But given the state of AI, given the rampant change, it's not 10 years from now, it's not 5 years, it's now. That reality is upon us. So it's almost an existential question about like how much energy we as a society are going to put into STEM education to try to maintain competitive edges. This is not even about doing the right thing. It's more about, you know, if you want to look at it from pure nuts and bolts economics, this is something that we have to do. And we bifurcate on the tech sector, and we, you know, because they get a lot of attention, huge part of our economy, so stipulated. But the reality is, how do you define the tech sector when Internet of Things is everything? Mm-hmm. It's every place. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing Walmart rolling out robots in their stores. What does that tell you? What does that say about the future of those jobs? Yep. So we have this changing economy, and I'm going to butcher the number, but something like 45% of the jobs can be eliminated tomorrow. That is a real reality. And we have, as my friends have said, a moral obligation as corporations to help lead as we watch our policymakers sort of intellectually paralyzed, if you will, for a lack of a, you know, there's some children in the room, so I can't really say. But yeah, there's intellectually paralyzed in terms of how do we truly address these issues. So,
and can I just, like, this is such a brilliant panel. Thank you for, like, bringing us all together. I'm being inspired by these three. I just want to tie something that you said, Juan, and something, Brenda, that you said, and, like, just build on all of this, right? You talked about the need for role models, right? And you talked about, you know, just how the internet kind of everything, and I promise I'll make sense in a little bit. You know, role models are so important, and let's be super duper clear, there have always been women in STEM. There have always been people of color in STEM. The fact of the matter is that they were written out of the history of it, and we're only at the very forefront of starting to tell those stories. So the role models are there, and when, that's one of the things that we have to fight against. Like, you know, all of us are trained to some degree to be obedient. And part of the work of diversity and inclusion is learning how to un-obediousize ourselves. Like, I just made that word up, but it's, yeah, liberating ourselves. I like to make up language. It's one of my It's actually one of the things. I'm dyslexic, so I always have to fight against like norms. And so I think being like a little bit liberated and a little bit of rebellion is part of who I am. But like, we have to resist accepting the history that we're taught to find the history that actually happened, right? And so I think that when we talk about like women in STEM or people of color in STEM, it's not to say that they don't want to be there or they haven't been there. They've always been there. They've been written out so a certain subset of people can keep the power there. I mean, think about it. There were a higher percentage of women in computer science in 1980 than there are now.
And they were 100% in 1940.
Right, exactly, because they were the typists. The first coders were the typists, and programming was thought of to be a woman's work because they're supposed to be typing, right? So women were written out when, and the reason why women were written out of the history of STEM was because starting in the 1970s, there's a profit. Suddenly STEM became profitable. Suddenly computer science became profitable. And they're like, men were like, we want that profit, so we're going to push the women out and we're going to take it for ourselves. And that's why suddenly 13%, 14% of engineers are now women, right? So it is about like finding that liberation, finding that rebellion, to find the story there. The other thing that you said that I think just kind of triggered a thought, that something that the two of you, you know, really said, is if you're doing this work in your organizations, right, and if you don't have an intersectional marker for metric, because you talked about metrics early on, right, then you fundamentally aren't doing, you haven't done the full work, right? Because, you know, the idea of exhaustion, right, and the concept of intersectionality, which is the study of different levels of oppression, the most, you know, there's many layers of intersection, but like the most fundamentally oppressed people in our society are Black women, right? If you don't in your organization have a metric that looks at Black women, not just women, not just Black people, but Black women, you fundamentally aren't measuring the right thing. And I've said at Uber, and we actually have this as part of our scorecard, is I have a metric on Black women. And I said, friendly, we can get rid of everything else. If I had that one metric, and if that one metric is not moving, then we're not moving, mm-hmm. right? So.
And yeah, and obviously there is not, as you guys have said, this is an ongoing conversation. This is work and constant work, so there's not one solution. But speaking from your own positions, creating different kinds of efforts, coming into a company that's seeking to change, what programs or initiatives have you personally started? I know, Bo and Juan, you can speak to this with Uber and Comcast, at your companies that have maybe helped in some way, you know, as a solution.
Jim, I'll be... Why don't you go ahead? You go first. I'll come back. Oh, yeah.
Sure. We're very polite.
We're very inclusive. Our panel is very inclusive.
A couple of thoughts. I mean, first off, as we just had the conversation on metrics, we put out more metrics every year. It's an exhausting process. It truly is, because we are a huge company. So whether that's the cable divisions are going to Sci-Fi TV or US Today, everybody will render unto Caesar and show us where your numbers are in terms of women. We will, due to Bo's point, you know, we're looking at our Latino population, for example, at NBCU. Oh, for damn sure, we're pulling out Telemundo numbers, because I want those numbers separate to show, let me see what the network is doing per se. So we have a very honest, robust, you know, conversation with our various properties. And it's an important conversation because it's those proof points you cannot hide from the numbers. To thine own self be true. The other piece that I don't care how big or small an organization is that direction from the top in terms of having chief diversity officer, having the CEO talking about this, doing what we call in Comcast World the road shows where we go out and we talk to each of the divisions, kick the tires. That governance piece is super important because, again, it's just we are holding you accountable and we're holding ourselves accountable. We also have this unique thing where we are Joint Diversity Council, where we have brought in outside leaders and they're under a do not disclose, and they come twice a year and they help us kick the tires. I think somebody else said on the panel, if you think you can figure this out by yourself and you're the smartest people in the room, you're wrong. So having folks come in and tell us, and whether that's Mark Morial from the Urban League or, you know, Janet McGeer from UNEOS, having very high-profile leaders who do not have a dog in our profitability fight, but rather have a dog in representing their communities coming in. And again, it's Latinx, it's African-American, Asian, LGBTQ, veterans. Again, that evolving ecosystem that's happening because we continually look at that committee, which is 24 people, which is one of the largest ones. It's a lot of people that we meet with twice a year.
And I would say, I really echo from the Microsoft perspective all of what you said. We actually think that it is important for us to be transparent to the public. So you can find Microsoft transparency reports, which on our website that we update every year, that talk about the progress that we hope that we have made. And you will see that it is progress. It is slow progress, but it is there and it's publicly available. And those transparency reports are done on an annual basis, and we hold ourselves to them. So that's really important. I will also say, though, that in terms of one of the things that really hasn't been mentioned so far is that this is an ecosystem, and we really believe it's important to advocate publicly on a policy and a legislative at state and federal levels for this work to go forward. So, for example, 5 years ago, only 12 states counted a computer science class to be included in a math or a science requirement to graduate from high school. It was otherwise treated as an elective class. That number is now 48. We've done lots and lots of work to get that number up. But still, only half of the high schools in the United States today have a computer science curriculum. Guess what? The ones that don't have curriculums are very often in rural areas of the country or in poor urban areas of the country. And we know what that data is. We are pushing hard to ensure that every kid gets a chance to take some computer science in high school. We started our own program about 9 years or so, where we are recruiting computer science engineers from Microsoft and now 500 other companies, a program called TEALS. We're teaching this year in 500 schools, volunteer computer scientists teaching in a school side by side with a teacher, in the hopes that the teacher will then, a year from now, be able to, and will actually, teach computer science on his or her own. Those classes are 40% girls and 30% young people of color. So again, the numbers are stronger than they are in the absence of that sort of support. So you have to do the advocacy. There is no question you do the advocacy, but words are not enough. You have to, the deeds as well as the words are really, really important. So next steps on our front, frankly, we need to support our teachers. We need to provide opportunities for teachers to engage in professional development so that they can continue to learn the science and computer science and advance in their own careers too, to create the capacity to teach and to make teaching a profession which is paid for as noble as it is.
On that topic of teachers, they play such a pivotal role in our society, and to your point, we don't value them the way they do because I believe majority of teachers are female, and therefore we pay them like females, right? I mean, it fundamentally comes down to that, and like we have to support them. And there's this amazing body, in addition to like teaching them the subject matter of STEM and making sure that they're prepared to teach, there's this amazing body of work being done by an academic named Christopher Emden at Teachers College at Columbia University. And he wrote an amazing book a few years ago that anyone who teaches any diverse set of people, and the book is called For White People Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all as well. It's an amazing, amazing book. And it basically, he introduces the concept of reality pedagogy. And in that book, basically reality pedagogy says we teach children, the way we teach children is never cultural neutral, right? And we teach children to fit, like that socialization of covering begins in the classroom. And inadvertently, teachers start to teach those who are not part of the power structure to cover, to be part, to try to be as less threatening as possible. So we teach girls to try to act like boys. We teach black people to act like white people in the classroom. And so that, like, it, and it's inadvertent. I'm not blaming the teachers at all. This is just a part of the way curriculum is designed right now. And what Christopher Emden really does is he says, if, in order for us to really educate black people and make sure that they are being taught in a way to be successful, we actually have to reflect their culture and what we are doing. They're and not just like, it's not like a stereotype, bringing in hip-hop into the classroom. Like, that's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is saying there are communication norms, there are behavioral norms, there are hierarchical norms, there are emotional expression norms within certain communities, archetypical norms, and those are oppressed when they come into the classroom. So when black boys and black girls come into the classroom, right, they're being taught not to be black in order to be successful. And we need to bring that reality back. We have to validate the culture. So if we're talking about STEM education and diversifying STEM education, we have to say, how are we changing the classroom to make it validating for people of color? We've done slightly better job of that from a gender perspective, and schools like MIT, Carnegie Mellon, they're actually doing that. They're changing their curriculum. They're changing the way for girls. But they're not right now doing that for people of color. And it's, and you know, these changes will fundamentally make it better for everybody and make them more successful, because we know right now the educational system from K-12 and in the university levels and the preschool levels are designed in a way to ensure the failure of people of color, and especially black boys and girls in our schools.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate to cut you off, but it looks like we're doing Q&A now. And I just want to make sure that people that came have a chance to ask questions too. So, yeah. Okay, the first one here is, how do you address failure to increase the Black, Latino, and Native American presence in the tech sector in contrast to other minority groups?
So I'll start that off. I think that we've, in the tech sector, for far too long basically said, well, they're not in the, you know, university pipeline, and so therefore we're just creating a reflection of what the pipeline looks like. And we've basically more or less said that for a really long time. And as our excuse, I think there are certain companies that are trying now to look for alternative sources, because they realize, based on everything that everybody here has said, Blacks, Latinx, Native Americans have been excluded intentionally from those pipelines. And so you have to look at alternative sources. A really great program and a partnership that Uber has really just started is with a great program called the Hidden Genius Project. It's a group that is founded in Oakland, California. And what they do is they go into lower income communities, and they specifically work with black boys and young men. And they ask black boys and young men, do you have an interest in a tech career? There's no prerequisites other than do you have an interest? And if a black boy raises his hand and says, yes, I do, they will bring them in and start to train them and teach them how to be successful in that, give them education. And so we started a fellowship program with the Hidden Genius Project, where we bring in young black boys and young men, and they go through a one-year fellowship where we bring them in every month, and they're paired with a mentor engineer. We put them through education, and the really great thing about our fellowship, and we've only done 1 year, so I don't want to say we've revolutionized everything, and in that 1 year, we only brought in 12 boys and men. of the 12, seven of them were offered full-time internships into our regular engineering internship program, which is typically for junior computer science majors, because they did such a good job through the fellowship. And then three more of those, so six or I think seven of ours, and then three more of the 12 got actually internships at Facebook. So slowly we're starting to bring in like talent. Now that's 12. How do we make that hundreds, right? Yeah. So, but you have to go to alternative sources.
So I just a couple of quick things there and agree. Yeah. I think for one thing, mm-hmm. we've only recruited at the top 20 schools, which is
absolutely
ridiculous. So more and more focusing on recruiting at historical Black colleges, other schools, schools in the Midwest, frankly. So we're doing, you know, we're increasing, certainly increasing broadly the number of schools from whom we recruit. The other thing, and we're just getting started with this, so again, like Bo, I wouldn't say that it's a revolution, but we are more and more talking about hiring people with a post-secondary certificate, not necessarily a college degree, not even necessarily a two-year degree. But if it is a program where we know that young people, or even not even young people, people like my age, are getting skills, then, you know, being much more open to hiring. There's a great program actually right here in Seattle called Apprenti that really focuses on bringing in people. It's a year-long program, learning computer science skills and other skills along with it. They're in partnership with 12 corporations here in the city who agree to take a graduate of the one-year certificate program in as an apprentice and a hire. So looking at alternative ways is absolutely, I think, absolutely critical in alternative places. And then all the other stuff we've been talking about. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I just, to that point, I think in the last 5 years, that dialogue has really changed. I think companies like Microsoft have really led on it. Because, you know, we have in Washington State, for the people here, we all know the University of Washington, computer science, and that's it. And if you don't get into that program, forget about it. Well, guess what? There are seats here at Seattle U. There's an amazing program at Central. Western is incredible. And really, it's like we need the companies, because it is about the network. And so the people that currently at all the bigger tech companies went to the Carnegie Mellons, the UWs. And so, you know, it's natural that you hire from there. But we need to disrupt and realize, like, you know, if you went to, like, I went to Federway High School, I didn't have the chance, you know, maybe to go to the best college. Then I get, you know, boxed out of going to the best companies, and then don't have a seat at the table. So I really love the leadership that's really coming. We actually just expanded also into certificates and into technical programs, because guess what? You can have an awesome living wage in this state without a four-year degree. And then maybe later on you want to go get the four-year degree, or you don't. And that's awesome. We can have lots of different paths. And, you know, kind of celebrating that is really important. But really, you have to invest the money. Companies have to invest the dollars in doing these hard things that Mary and Bo and Juan are talking about, or else it's going to be status quo.
No, and that was the point I was going to make on this, that, you know, again, defining tech is sort of, okay, we can get into the definitional piece in terms of how the economy has changed and continues to evolve, because I think everything is tech in some level. But the point that was just made, I think, is key. This does not happen by osmosis. This is an on continuing effort that requires leadership from the top all the way down, with accountability built into that system. So yes, there has been a failure, but now that we are having this public dialogue, we're having this conversation, it's a robust one and it's not going away. So how do we do that for the future with a constant watch to see those metrics improve? And I'm also a big believer that, you know, to quote Chairman Mao, let 1,000 flowers bloom. There's a whole different way that different companies can do this. A lot of folks get pigeonholed into, like, well, that's the way Comcast NBCU does it. Well, that's fine. That worked for our ecosystem. For Uber, it might be different. For Microsoft, it might be different. How do you do that? But all of these lessons learned. So there's a lot of good work that's being out there. And I am proud to say that I poach from IBM, like I poach from other companies. And one of the things we were talking about, employee, you know, how do we get people into the system? We use our employees. We go to our ERGs and say, we have a cadre of African-American engineers. They call themselves the Benjineers. It's like, okay, instead of going to a bunch of conferences, we have 10 jobs in Houston. We have 5 jobs in Seattle. Can you help us fill those jobs? We are looking for folks of color. Can you help us do that? And that has proved to be a successful strategy.
Yeah. Do we have time for one more question? Yes? Okay. Okay.
2 minutes.
I will ask one more question. this one is, when we talk about D&I, we often talk about programs, but not the racist and exclusionary behaviors of bad actors. What behaviors need to stop?
Oh my God.
I know. It's like, and answer this.
Wait, how much time did you say we have? Yeah. Why
is that? 2 minutes. Yeah. Go.
In an ideal world, like, there's always going to be bad actors. Every company has them because we employ people from society. We don't pull them from a cocoon. So people bring in their social biases, right? The hope is that every company, so it's not about like the fact that you're going to eliminate bad actors, right? The hope is that, well, you are going to eliminate them, but the hope is that when those bad actors appear, you know, you've inadvertently brought them into your organization, that you have a system to identify the behavior, to investigate those situations, and to correct for the behavior, whether it is, you know, getting that person coaching, getting that person training, or firing them if they are not somebody who can fundamentally change, right? And having the courage to be able to do that, and having a system that is truly, you know, robust. Like, that was actually one of the failures that Uber had. And that's one of the things that led to the events of 2017 and in 2018, is that we had a lot of bad actors, and we didn't have a good system to fix it.
Yeah, I'd say I agree with you completely. Yeah. It's more than a system. You have to create a culture of safety so people feel as though they can talk about it if a supervisor is behaving inappropriately. And then, yes, process and accountability. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and we talk about conscious and unconscious bias, but creating that culture of conscious inclusion that folks feel the opportunity is like, yes, I can put my head up and say that was not an appropriate behavior. And, you know, building into the systems is, you know, anonymous, not so anonymous. You know, if you can't talk to your supervisor, go outside. There's a lot of processes. Again, I think that's almost a relatively simple move if you're willing to have that conversation. Yeah. And we want to build in that device to be protective.
Right. And then, go ahead.
I was going to say, we have hit our time, but Nari, I want you to finish your thought.
I just want to say one thing. You guys talked about the policies. I want to talk about the microaggressions, because I think that those are the things that you can't really name. And I would say the one key thing is, if you're a white person in this room, you know, don't look to the people of color to teach you. Go out and take accountability and learn. And, you know, the teaching moments are often very, very exhausting. So that's the biggest thing. And the second thing, to piggyback on the culture.
Good note to leave.
The culture really is like culture of safety, and creating that so that you can speak out if you do experience those things.
Yeah.
Go learn.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.